Have you heard of the Grabber?
Yeah, who hasn't?
Killed a bunch of kids and then got killed when Watt escaped.
Yeah, his name was Finney something?
Finney Blake.
Finney Blake? Holy shit!
Welcome to the 3 Minute Retrospectives look at the Black Phone films.
You didn't bring me here. I brought myself.
Join Garrett.
Today's the day, motherfucker!
Matt.
I know him and I know his face.
And Adam.
A man never leaves a friend behind.
As they look at the film series based off of author Joe Hill's short story taken from his published collection, 20th Century Ghosts.
Looks like you'll find those naughty boys after all.
After a highly successful first movie, does the Ethan Hawke portrayed Grabber still have what it takes to sustain a horror franchise?
It wasn't the devil attacking me in the kitchen, it was him.
Find out next. Courtesy of Percolated Media.
I'm getting to that, cuntwad! Or you have some other important shit you have to do right now?
No. I'm listening.
Black Phone 2, Dream Warriors, released October 17th, 2025. Budget on this was $30 million. Box office, $132 million, which probably means we're going to get another one. And this was directed once again by Scott Derrickson. Guys, our first year in existence, probably our first few months, the three of us decided we wanted to do a surprise podcast for listeners and throw a review of Black Phone up, not knowing if there was going to be a sequel, not really counting on there being a sequel. But here we are a set of years later, and yes, it has taken us a set of months to get to it. We had other things going on. We couldn't get to it at the time we did, but we figured in between Hulk and King, we could throw this in between, and I think it's a pretty good place to set this.
Well, it's technically part of Stephen King.
Technically, yes.
So I guess on a technicality, based on your bullshit definition, we would have had to review this at some point.
Here we are. And the thing about Joe Hill is, unlike his father, Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, he seems to be a little more diplomatic with his properties, doesn't he? We've had Horns. We had Black Phone. There hasn't been too much made of his work, so he seems a little more protective of it.
Oh, he also doesn't have the vast library quite yet that his father has. But you also had Lock and Key, which was made into a TV show. That was a pretty big one. But yeah, he also doesn't have the clout that his father does, both in name recognition and creative input, I would imagine, on these productions.
Now, the three of us gave the first Black Phone a pretty decent review. Go back and check that out in our archives. It's there. Matt, were you at all looking forward to a sequel?
Yes, but not in the way I expected. When they announced a sequel to this, I wasn't shocked because this is the genre more so than any other that the moment the check clears and they're in the black, they'll greenlight a sequel faster than you can snap your fingers. But I was concerned because I thought the first one, what I liked so much about it, on top of almost everything that I liked about it, was for something that was supernatural in concept with the titular object, so much of it felt steeped in reality, and it was authentic with the way it got into places that I didn't think a modern movie would have the balls to do, with like authentic child abuse and certainly child endangerment in movies. That's also become a big no-no in a lot of circumstances. So I thought it did a great balance, and I was not annoyed when they announced a sequel, but I thought the only thing they can do now is go fully into the supernatural, and I didn't want that because I feel like you'd be sacrificing a lot of what made the first one work for me. But lo and behold, when Joe Hill is the writer on this, or at least to an extent, I shouldn't be surprised that they're going to take a more supernatural take, because a lot of Stephen King stuff, I've said, the stuff I like best are the ones that are little to no supernatural, or it's there as just a framework, which the first film was in a lot of degrees. So I wasn't thrilled that they announced the sequel, but I was also confident that it was the same team, so I was expecting to at least be satiated on that front.
Adam, my friend, you gave the first Black Phone a pretty good review. What were you thinking when they announced, oh, here's a sequel?
Why?
Cha-ching!
This is Jason Blum we're talking about, sir.
And you took exactly my point. Okay. Yep, that's my next part. Jason Blum, who, you know, never met a nickel that he could not squeeze into 8 pennies. So, I mean, I didn't need it. I didn't want it. I was skeptical as could be. But to Matt's point, like, look, you brought everybody back. You even got, you know, see Robert Carhill back to write. So at least you're not pushing it off. At least you're not going, hey, we let him give us a story treatment out of obligation, and now we're doing whatever the hell we want. I don't know. That first one is just seemed kind of a perfect one-off story. And in a universe where I consider franchise to be the biggest F word in Hollywood, I wish we could have just more single movies to be proud of. But we don't. So surprised, no. But I can't say I was excited. Even in the lead up to it, look, I was at Universal that fall. There was black phone stuff everywhere. I got pictures inside a snowed out phone booth in Florida. But because of vacation, I didn't see this. And this thing was in and out of theaters quickly.
Still made more than triple its budget. So it's not like it was a non-success.
And with anything else, look, if this was a different studio, this thing would have been overblown with budget-wise and all that. And he kind of runs the gamut, but I'll give Blumhouse credit that they make quality movies with a reasonable budget. And no other production in Hollywood seems to have figured that out yet.
Well, speaking of the production, one thing that I was curious about was Derrickson, if you know his career, he didn't direct Sinister 2. And he left Doctor Strange 2 over clear creative differences. And I know that that phrase gets thrown out a lot, but it really does sound like he had he clearly had a direction with what he wanted to do, that Marvel said, bitch, you're doing the multiverse, stick with it. And he said, like, F you, I'm not going to do it. So I was surprised that after two instances, one in which he handed it off to someone, and one which he left voluntarily, that he was coming back in full force to do this, surprised me.
Well, that was kind of due to a verbal obligation to Joe Hill. Because when Joe Hill sold the rights to them, he did give a concept to Derrickson that said the sequel would consist of the Grabber calling Finn from hell. And from that, Derrickson was like, that is a great idea. Let's see if this thing is successful first. Sure as shit, Black Phone is released to massive success. And they greenlit this pretty quick. But that was the concept, and they ran with it. So, Matt, you've seen the trailers come out. Are you at all excited for this?
Well, it's funny that pitch you talked about with Joe Hill. That's what Jason Blum did. That was his whole business model initially, was I'll give you like $10 million if you give me a good pitch. And Derrickson, when he pitched Sinister, that's how he got the job, was he said, like, you know those movies about the found footage? And Blum was like, yeah. He goes, I don't know the exact verbiage he said, but he's like, I'm making a movie about the guy who finds all that stuff. And he goes, take it from there. So I could see wanting to do the reversal of that for Joe Hill. But once the marketing for this came out and it was clear that he being the Grabber himself, was going to be like a supernatural villain, I clinched up. I couldn't help it, because I really liked what Ethan Hawke did in that first movie. It's not that I didn't want him to come back. I just felt, while it was the obvious thing to do, I didn't like that they were just, based on the marketing, making him a supernatural Krueger-esque type of vindictive demon. And I'm not going to call that a step too far, because this is a horror. It's horror of all things, and it's more often than not fantastical by nature. But it's not the direction I wanted if you were going to do a sequel to this at all, which I personally, if I had final say, I would not do this at all. But nothing about it really excited me. As far besides the team, while the trailers look good, I just was not sold on doing this direction.
All right, Adam, trailers start coming out, marketing's out. What are you thinking? Are you at least a little bit excited for Black Phone 2?
More of the marketing I saw, the worse I was feeling about it. Look, when I get a sequel, I don't want it to be copy, paste, repeat. I do want there to be some changes, but this seemed like it was a different movie in like all possible ways than the first one was. And other than the fact that you had a phone, I didn't see really much of any connection. And that worried me, that confused me. And then I started hearing, when this was getting screened, what some of the people were calling and comparing this movie to. And that is kind of when I put my hands up and went, all right, fuck it, I'll wait.
Yeah, you know what? I mentioned that we had a lot of other things going on. I think a lot of the reason why we waited so long to review this is because I don't think any of us wanted to see it. Because I was the same exact way, and I don't even think I saw it in theaters. I said the same thing. I'm like, fuck it, I'm just going to wait for digital for this thing. Not worth the effort. And then the reviews started coming out, and they were pretty negative. But there was one that stuck out to me that was on X that called it not as good as the first, but better. Guess who that was?
Yeah. Stephen King himself.
Yeah, King himself endorsed the film. And I did watch it because we had kind of planned on doing it like around Christmas time, and I watched it with Jen, and I think I fell asleep in that first time watching it, and I only got my notes for it in the last couple weeks. But Matt, you saw this in theaters, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, because it came out around, it was like the middle of October, so it was Halloween appropriate, but it's also like appropriate for Christmas, given the climate that the movie takes place in. And it got largely favorable reviews. It's got a 72% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is positive. You know, that's nothing to scoff at, especially if you're a horror film.
Yeah.
Like, for a horror, but, for this kind of budget? Oh, yeah, God.
Especially
yeah.
for a Blumhouse sequel?
Yeah.
When I saw that, I felt a little bit more confident. But my confidence was shaken when I saw Stephen King put out that tweet, because I feel like that man has the cinematic palette of like McDonald's, where it's whatever he's feeling, whatever he's craving, whatever side of the bed he woke up on that day. I'm convinced he could see the same movie on two different days and he'd walk out with two completely separate takes.
Adam, I'm assuming you waited for digital for this, right?
I did, yeah.
Waited until yesterday.
But by the way, when you went and saw this, Matt, was it a crowded theater? Was it go opening weekend, so I'm assuming it was pretty crowded.
Yeah, I like going opening weekend because I enjoy the atmosphere, and then I say I hate all of you when you don't shut up. So I guess I have to change my perception, but the horror films are just fun to see in a theater. They just are. And this one, I will say, unlike the first one, this one's much more of a like a prototypical horror film than the previous one.
Oh my God, yes. Yeah, you could make an argument that, with the exception of, because I did rewatch the first Black film before watching the second one for this review, you could make an argument, with the exception of the phone calls that come from another world, I guess you could say, it's pretty much a straightforward thriller, right?
Now you could argue it's a horror film in the same way that like Seven is. People will make that argument. But yeah, I think this one's much more of like what you think of as horror film, especially with the scare component and even the way some of it's framed. It's a lot more of like your modern horror films, although it takes inspiration from some big staples of the 80s.
Oh, yeah. So let's get there. We open up. I'll tell you one thing that got me off on the right foot. It hits that nostalgia thing for me. But Adam, was it awesome seeing this old school Universal logo? Was it as awesome for you as it was for me? Because I sure fucking popped for this.
That was cool. And yeah, I like that. And I keep forgetting this is Universal, which is, I don't know how I forget that, being that every year I go to Horror Nights and I take pictures with the grabber, because they have Blumhouse now really in depth at Halloween Horror Nights. But I do like that old school logo. And it makes me think that it puts it in a time frame right away, which we complimented the first one for, that it gave a feel back to those 80s kind of horror movies.
But that's immediately followed up by the Blumhouse logo, which isn't as nostalgic.
No, and oh my God. Can someone edit this logo, please? It's like 40, it's 45 seconds. I shit you not. It's 45 seconds, and it's him trying, because it's like, it's not just one frame from the movies that are like encapsulated. No, it's scenes from like four different Blumhouse productions stitched together like Frankenstein. I am annoyed every time I see it.
Thank God this wasn't produced by James Wan, because once his Atomic Monster logo comes, it's like, Jesus fucking Christ, that logo takes forever too.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, that's true.
And I was also wondering that Blumhouse puts Halloween in there. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, you made Halloween movies, but that's like Blumhouse putting The Exorcist in their logo, except for the fact that they're ashamed that they actually made that piece of shit.
Give it a year.
Oh, I know. Trust me. It's on the schedule.
Yep. We see a phone being dialed in the snowy Rocky Mountains in the year 1957.
I was waiting for John Denver to kick in. Rocky Mountain.
We're hearing that the scene is taking place in Alpine Lake, which is a youth camp in the mountains. And this girl who's answering the phone, she's having bad dreams of seven numbers that were carved in ice. She asks who is on the other end of the phone as static picks up and the phone goes dead. She walks away from the booth as we get some opening credits. So, I guess intrigued to say the least.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that, you know, you got a phone booth just chilling out in the middle of a freaking snowstorm, but okay, you know, I will go with the rules that you set up for me. I think that I'm going to put that at the front because that's really important. I'm going to go with the story and rules you set up for me. So right away, it's visually grabbing. Grabber.
Nice.
And yeah, you know, I'm ready to go for it. But suddenly we're getting a different kind of phone call and numbers. And it's not the same, but it feels like what we got before, but kind of radically different.
Who built this camp? That's my question, because I want to know what fucking power service they have that in the middle of the mountains, they can put a phone booth in scenic nowhere, and it still functions routinely.
Let's not forget.
Because forget the supernatural. Like, let's say they were out on the lake and someone fell through the ice, which, as we'll find out, has happened, and you have to call the police. Like, you're going to reach 911 with that payphone?
Let's not forget, this whole movie is based on the concept of dreams, so I'm not convinced that this is real. We once again get some Seven-style credits, kind of detailing what the movie's going to consist of, and yep, this sure as hell feels like a Nightmare on Elm Street, doesn't it? We've been dancing around it. Let's just fucking get it out there right now. This is some Nightmare on Elm Street shit.
They are, and Cargill openly talked about Dream Warriors was like, that's what they set out to make, basically, was their version of that. And look, I appreciate when you're candid about it. I'm always annoyed when people kind of dance around their influences, but this one in particular annoys me in the movie because I think they go too far from homage to just blatant ripoffs in certain aspects. But it's also hard to do because Freddy wrote the book on like conventional horror dream logic, and then that book got subsequently rewritten over and over by that franchise. Yeah. But look, as someone who has not, we have not had a Nightmare on Elm Street movie in 15 years, to a certain degree, this kind of cleansed my palate a little bit for that.
Yep. And Adam, as the one who's going to be doing that retrospective with us in the next couple of years, how'd you feel about seeing this kind of Nightmare on Elm Street homage, quote unquote?
These opening credits made me, like, my note is, what are these credits? I'm clearly getting a different story. And I think that was a good thing. Like I said, I don't want to rinse repeat, so it at least lets me know that I'm getting something different. It feels, very Seven. Like, David Fincher should be calling up and going, who the hell did your opening credits?
Yeah, except no one's going to be on the other line.
But it sets a mood. I'll say, 5 minutes in, I'm kind of like, shit, I wish I saw this on big screen.
I'll say this, the man knows how to open a movie, because like, if the opening of Sinister doesn't, pardon the pun, grab you, with them all being hung. This also had, there was a VHS segment in between the first, this movie and the first movie that Derrickson directed as part of this franchise. So there was technically something in between. I wonder if that was almost like a test run to see, like, do I really want to do this again?
Maybe. We then cut to Denver in 1982 as we see a fight break out and a kid is just getting pummeled by our character from the last film, Finn, who tells the kid to stay the fuck away from him. So here's our reintroduction to Finn. A little bit of a growth spurt in between. What has it been, 4 years? So I guess we're two to expect that, right, Matt?
Yeah, well, I feel like that was done by default because you could not set this a year later or anything like that because these two kids have clearly visibly aged. And I like that we're introduced to him in the first film. He's the one getting beat up. This one, he's the one doing the bullying.
Yeah. So
that's I thought that was pretty fun. But I also like that this movie doesn't ignore the first film as much as I thought it would. Which I know that sounds silly to say, but like a lot of this movie is dealing with the consequences of that and how certain people handle trauma different ways. And sometimes things happen to you that you just don't get over.
Like that he's going through some shit. I mean, it feels pretty damn natural. And look, if you were getting picked on and suddenly you decided to grow 6 inches, not that you decided, but if you, I was like, I can't believe that they actually, like, this is a reverse 90210 situation.
Right.
And he's not doing it to be a bully. He's just tired of being picked on. And, sometimes you're like, I can stand up for myself. And this is the result of it. But I couldn't believe it was, I was like, is that the same kid? I had to pause it and look, and I'm glad they got the same actors back in, even though it can be confusing because of how much they've changed physically.
So he tells Gwen that the kid started it, and she says that he didn't have to be so hard on him, and Finn says that the more blood you spill, the better your point is made, which seems to kind of be the point of this entire sequel. It's the theme, at least. She says that maybe the point he's making isn't so much don't fuck with me as it's I'm the kid to beat, which is actually a pretty good point.
To be fair, he has bragging rights. He's the only one that escaped the grabber and also killed him.
You're not fucking kidding. And how that doesn't get... okay, we'll get there. Ernesto...
Yep.
Ernesto pulls up and compliments Finn on his fight and then invites them to the Civic Center for Duran Duran tickets. And Gwen says that it'd be radical if she could go. And Finn calls it a date, which she kind of swats away. So Gwen, another one that gets the growth spurt. And she also kind of gets the plot of this movie, doesn't she, Matt?
Well, I think this was also smart to do, make her the focal point. And I didn't realize that this, I know it's the same actress, I forgot that she was in, what was the name? She did the voice in Toy Story 4 of the little girl.
Yes.
I'm like, oh yeah, that is her.
I think it's a good way to do it. I also like that it's not telegraphed in the trailers. I think
it's a telephone, not a telegraph.
God.
I think it's handled a hell of a lot better than, Obi-Wan fucking Kenobi TV series. Let's just give it a random example. Sorry, bitter. I think it's a good way to go. We complimented the hell out of her in the first movie, that she was kind of a revelation. And I think she still has a good future, even when she's given some really bad dialogue for the next 90 minutes. Because this thing is written like Stephen King is trying to write an 80s movie today. So some of the dialogue and language is just stunted in its, you know, verbiage. I was just more struck by Ernesto because I was like, okay, so we're getting a few new characters. No, they'd forgotten that this kid is the brother of one of the killed kids from last time.
That took me till near the end of the movie to figure out.
Yep. When they finally explain it at the end of the movie that my brother was killed.
Which I get wanting to work with the same actors, but Jesus Christ.
You just like explain it.
Yeah.
Just a drop line, you know, of, especially because they discuss this concert. It's, you know, look what his brother went through. Because then I would know, oh, snap, I got it.
Mm-hmm. Finn says that he doesn't really like Ernesto, and he's very protective of his little sister. We get a reintroduction to Terrence, Finn's dad, and one thing Cargo and Derrickson pointed out in the lead-up to this movie and the marketing for it is they wanted to kind of give Terrence a little bit of an arc because he kind of came off really poorly in the first film, and they kind of wanted to pay that off. And in rewatching that first film, they're absolutely right. He comes off as a dick. Here, he's actually a little more of a sympathetic dad. Adam, as somebody who's the dad of teenagers, this kind of plays, doesn't it?
It does. First film we talked about that he was good, but the strap, the belt, like it, as accurate as it was, it's hard to watch, you know, and it sets a tone for who somebody is. And I'm glad they give him a little more in this one. And I think redeem is a weird word, but you understand the father quite a bit more in this one than we did last time.
Well, it's actually like character progression. This reminds me of, speaking of Nightmare, this is like the Alice's father from 4 to 5.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's clearly influenced by that, but I was surprised he was in the, like, this is very much a sequel in the traditional sense of returning characters, but I appreciate that they're actually moving these characters along, which I thought this movie was just going to hit the same beats over and over, like he was going to relapse because his son got kidnapped and all that sort of stuff that they thankfully tap dance around.
So Terrence goes to bed and tells Finn not to stay up too late. And man, in these days, it was horror film city for me. Whether it was on cable or from the video store, this was the time I would put on a horror movie. Either that or a wrestling event or maybe a Star Wars film. Like, I would stay up all night if my parents told me to not stay up too late. But Finn is still up as Duran Duran is playing in the background. I'm guessing that's Duran Duran. And he walks outside, and then he starts smoking a joint as he has visions of when he was taken in the last film.
To be fair, if I had that happen to me, I'd definitely be smoking pot all the time.
Dude, I'd be doing more than that. I see where they're going with this, and you know, you could call it trite, but Matt, you're absolutely right. People handle trauma in different ways, but if you were to go through what he went through in that movie, I mean, he goes through some emotional craziness in that first film. You're right, this is how he would handle it, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not going so far overboard that you lose sympathy for him. He's not doing like, it's not like he's snorting coke, or he hasn't become like the full degenerate, like fully rebellious teenager. Because he's Finny, not Foley. God, I'm just on fire today with these.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah, I like that this is a plausible way to go without overstepping into, because I didn't want this to be fucking Laurie Strode, lives in a, never leaves the house or is homeschooled. Like, I didn't want something to that extent.
I feel like if you're going to smoke a joint, walk away from the just right outside the back door of your house. You know, you're a little too close to home.
How many times did we get in trouble smoking just outside the house? If you had a joint, that'd be even worse.
Yeah, I mean, hey kids, if you think it can't be smelled, guess what? Yes, it can.
But I like the fact that he's smoking a joint here, because we're even seeing the grabber in the background from his line of vision. So we could say that maybe it's because he's high that he's seeing these visions.
Yeah, he's either hallucinating or he's trying to numb himself off from the hallucination. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in either way, he's clearly not dreaming well, and he has trauma.
Yeah.
And God knows we don't handle trauma good now, more or less 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Not 1980. Yeah, they would have locked this kid in Weston Hills, like in Nightmare on Elm Street. Which, to be fair, like, there was a part of me, because this is the second movie and there's a lot of Freddy stuff, I thought this movie was going to, like, him being possessed by the grabber's spirit, like Nightmare 2.
You're taking one of my notes. I had that theory, too. Gwen refuses the joint and calls Finn a slapdick as she asks if he's okay. Finn says that he doesn't want to talk about how he feels, and she says it's okay that he feels the way he does. Then we have more visions, this of a school bus in the snow as we fade to the woods and we see someone being chased and stabbed by the grabber. We then see this kid write a W as Gwen's woken up by the phone. So we're already getting these nightmares developing.
Yep, they are. I don't know what's going on at this point, you know, but we're shifting perspectives and we learn really quick that this is Gwen's story. It's not, I mean, Finn is in it. Finn deals with some stuff, but it's definitely a shifting perspective.
I was starting to get a little tense about, I was worried this would go too far in their dream logic and lose focus as far as characters, that it would try to like excuse not having a main protagonist because it's just dream logic. So I was starting to get a little worried here. I'm not going to lie.
You know what? Me and you are on the exact same wavelength, Matt, because I'm feeling the exact same way, because I'm thinking this is going to be a movie where we're going to flip from dreams to reality and back again. And in my head, I'm thinking if it goes that route, I am not going to like this movie very much. So the phone's ringing as Derrickson's messing with some shaky cam. It continues ringing as Gwen looks outside and she hears Finn asking what she's doing as we cut to him being behind her. We then see him take her to her room saying that she was sleepwalking again. She says that she was just having a bad dream. Sleepwalking, man.
Wow, boy, sleepwalkers, huh? Yeah, thought we weren't getting there for a while.
Yeah. We cut to the next day at school as we see Gwen checking out books on dream interpretation. And then we see Ernesto coming through as she's given the Duran Duran tickets. And she reveals the shit that she believes in. But this doesn't scare him off as he offers her, what is this, tarot cards that he's offering her?
These are, they can be used as tarot. This is a Mexico primarily, but a Latin America, South America card. I hate to call it a card game, but there are games with Loteria. I think it's Loteria that's done that way. Loteria. So the closest thing would be, yeah, closest thing would be like a tarot.
Wow. Didn't think I get that answer. Thank you, Adam.
There's a Hellboy version of these cards.
Oh, that's
there you
why.
Go.
Yeah, that's why he knows.
That explains it. Gwen says that she doesn't want to talk about her dreams because they're weird, and Ernesto responds with, maybe I like weird. Then we get a weird cut to Finn answering a payphone and saying that he can't help the person on the other line as we cut to more visions, one of a kid moving through the snow and being chased, and it closes with him writing a B next to the W in the ice before he's woken up by another phone call.
Matt, Warner Brothers, WB.
They're about to be dead.
Matt, are you still scared at this point? And not of the movie, but of what you're about ready to see in the movie?
Yeah, I'm getting really, I don't like dream logic in a lot of movies. I'm notorious. It's one of the things I just dislike on a cinematic principle level. So I'm getting really antsy with what I'm hoping this ain't going to go the direction I'm thinking it is at this juncture.
Adam, you were into it 5 minutes ago. What are you feeling at this point?
I got a bad feeling about this. I'm starting to turn, and I'm turning pretty quickly because I don't know whose visions we're seeing. I don't know what your rules are. You're not making things clear. I don't know whose visions. Yeah, I'm really starting not to dig what's going on.
You know, I gotta say, as much as I was kind of not really looking forward to watching this movie, given, as you guys have mentioned, just all the marketing that pointed out that we're going to go supernatural with it, I'm kind of digging where I'm at this point. I gotta say, Jen tuned out of this pretty quick. She went to bed pretty quick. She did not like this, and she loved the first film. And at this point, though, I was kind of digging what I was seeing. So we once again see Gwen walking outside and see the remains of the grabber, and she continues walking, even climbing a fence as the ringing continues to happen. She goes and answers the phone and hears Hope Adler, who we're going to learn is her mother, and we're hearing the phone call that we saw earlier. So this is coming from 1957. She starts putting together what this Hope chick is saying, and as she says her name, the line is hung up. She turns around and hears more steps and commotion going on as the phone rings yet again. A lot of phone ringing in this. You know, if you have a surround system, you're going to look behind you because the phone rings so much in this movie. So Gwen is joined by Finn, who says that she came here in her sleep once again, and she says that she feels like she's going crazy, and she was on the phone talking to their mom. She says it wasn't just a dream, it was her, and she called Gwen from a youth camp. Finn turns around and looks at the graffiti on the wall as we cut to Gwen putting down the itinerary of the Christian boot camp, and they are accepting applications for counselors in training.
The day that I watched this, my oldest child was going for camp counselor training because she's going to be at scout camp this entire summer, but now she'll be a counselor. So wow. I could not believe the timing of it. But Christian camp out in the mountains, that's just, I feel like somebody is looking into some of Stephen King's works to try to find a way to write this story with where they're going and some of the people we meet.
this is the most unbelievable and unrealistic thing in the movie. It's this Alpine Lake camp. I mean, for one thing, if it's out in the Colorado Rockies, it should be a Mormon camp.
Right. Yeah.
Like, you're at least going to do that, but I guess you don't want to do that because South Park kind of cornered the market on making fun of the Mormons. Look, I know Catholicism plays in a lot of his work, in Derrickson's work, and King's for that matter. So I wasn't surprised, but I was a little annoyed that this felt the most, could just be a regular camp. It had to be a Christian camp.
Let's not forget how fucking religious Scott Derrickson is. He is.
No, that's why I'm saying I'm not surprised.
And there are times in this movie where it feels like a fucking Left Behind movie with how much fucking God.
Oh, God, I have expected Kirk Cameron to
be.
Except the only thing that's in the bottom of the lake is his career.
Finn says no to these pamphlets as Terrence comes and sees the Camp Alpine pamphlet for himself. He says that it actually closed in 1958 and then opens a beer-mumbling Christian camp. We see Ernesto pick Gwen up, and Terrence says to Finn that he doesn't like the way Ernesto looks at her. Finn then tells him to not get drunk while they're gone, and he responds with, he's done with all that, and in 2 weeks he gets his 3-year chip, and then Finn leaves.
There's some of this stuff going on with the dad, and I wonder which parts of this is Joe kind of wrestling with some of the demons with his dad and stuff. I mean, alcoholism obviously plays a part in everything Stephen King for a time, but I almost feel like this is Joe King doing some dad, I see you.
Yeah, that did play. I mean, it's still playing. I'm going through his bibliography now, and it is in a lot of his work where people are trying to recover from being alcoholics. So I think you're right on with that.
And I'm not saying that negatively because thankfully it does not take over. Like when this happens and he does it, I'm like, oh my God, I could see where this is going. And then it doesn't go there. And that's a pleasant surprise.
We get another brick in the wall, Adam, as they continue driving through some heavy fog and snowing conditions.
And Adam is singing along to the movie. Because it's Pink Floyd. You're damn right I am. So what? So you can't pay for Duran Duran, but you can afford a fucking Pink Floyd song in your movie? This thing had to cost more than the actor's salary.
I'm telling
you. All this thing was made for $30 million. I'm sure 10 of that went to Pink Floyd's wallet.
Finn says that he can't see the road. Boy, I can't say that I have not been here when you're driving through the snow and it looks like you're going through fucking hyperspace with all the snow going to your window. Finn says that he's going to run so he can see the road and they're going to find someone on a horse who says to follow her.
Hey, I can suspend disbelief. I can give a movie its conceits. After what these kids went through, what dad ends up going, yeah, okay, sure, go ahead. I don't understand why you're driving at night, and apparently we're heading to this hotel that's probably, I don't know, got a haunted bartender in it, because I feel like we're going to the freaking Outlook Hotel up this mountain. This is when I'm just like, none of this makes any sense. You're going to let your teenagers drive at night up the snow to this Christian camp you already don't know about, and apparently this flyer means you're accepted to this job a day later. I don't know. I'm suddenly checking on this film.
Wow, The Shining did take place in Colorado, so another thing, you might be right on with that.
Well, right down to the imagery, I'm thinking of The Shining, especially the movie. It's hard to escape that. I find this a little bit of a stretch, but I also can understand the father saying, I was so controlling and detrimental to my kids that maybe I do need to let them go and give them sort of that level of independence. So I can at least understand his rationale. But yeah, driving at night, that's the one thing I don't get. Apparently you can show up at 1 a.m. at this camp and register, and someone will be there. So I've been to hotels where the check-in service isn't that nice.
I know, me too. We're then meeting Armando, who's giving a lowdown on the fact that they won't plow the roads until the storm passes. This Armando's play by...
That's like them saying, oh yeah, the boiler's only in The Shining.
Yeah, right. This Armando's played by Damien Brashear, who's the star of Solo. No, not the movie we viewed a couple years ago, but one that me and Adam saw in theater starring Mario Van Peebles.
Mario Van Peebles joint.
This, of course, means that they're stuck. Gwen is led to her room, as is Finn, and the storm is really going as we're getting another reveal from the ice, which is an H this time. This causes Gwen to jerk up out of her sleep. Payphone's ringing again as Finn tells the other line that he can't help him, but the phone just continues on. We see Gwen check under the bed and she finds a body as Finn hears the grabber's voice for the first time since the first film, and this throws him for a loop. We see the dead kids rise up and surround them as we see a decapitated head try to speak, and Finn heads to find Gwen. He yells at her to wake up as she asks what's happening to her. Gwen then says that she had a bad dream, and Ernesto offers her to lie down, and she tells Ernesto to not dream anymore tonight, and then Ernesto asks if she really talks to Jesus like that. When she responds with yes, he says he thinks it's hot. Oh boy.
Who wrote that line?
Terrible line.
I have said some completely out of sorts things, but never it's hot that you talk badly to Jack.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
Gwen tells Ernesto about the conversation with her mom, and she says that she's scared that the same thing is going to happen to her. She asks that she hopes that he doesn't see her as a freak, and Ernesto asks what's so weird about being a freak. He then calls her beautiful as he leans for a kiss, and we hear Finn ask if Ernesto finds him beautiful too. I actually kind of laughed at this.
Great way to finish the scene. That's
not at a Christian camp. That shit ain't happening.
We cut to the next day, and Finn is pissed that Gwen told Ernesto about her dreams, and when Finn says that he didn't say anything to his friends, Gwen responds, "That's because you didn't have any." Ouch. You know, we can say a lot of negative things about the dialogue in this, but one thing I do believe is that these two are brother and sister. They do write these two pretty well, and they play off each other really well.
They do. And we said before, like, they got a good chemistry together. That carries on to this one. They're a good match. Like, I don't like everything they're being given to say, but they definitely feel like brother and sister picking on each other. This is like me driving and me having both kids in the backseat.
I'm sure.
It's still there, and that's one of the things that I really liked in the first one, and it's not like they share a ton of scenes together. But here, I like that they changed the main protagonist's perspective, but they still kept both of them together. I think this is done pretty well, and especially for a movie that's a little under 2 hours. But there's also part of me that thinks with the way this movie's written, I could see this more as a book than I would an actual movie. Because I think the first one, they did a good job of expanding a short story into a feature. This one, I think this would have worked better as like a script that's converted into a book. Especially with like the perspective and the dream logic. I feel like that transitions better into a book.
Gwen then shows the bruises on her arm, which she got from her dream when one of the kids grabbed her. And then Finn says, this isn't good. We cut to an uncomfortable dinner as Finn asks how many other people are here, and everyone says that they slept just fine. Finn says that their mom went here and she died years ago. When they ask if they remember her, they're told a lot of kids come through here, and they ask for her camp name. They show her picture, and they're told that she was Starlight, and she was a true light around here. Oh, boy. Armando apologizes about the fact that they lost her, and they tell him that she committed suicide.
Which, okay, get a little worried here, because I'm like, okay, they're talking about the mom a lot.
Yes.
So clearly there is something that is going to be revealed, and I was terrified where this was going.
Me too. They're told to call their families to let them know that they're okay, and when Finn asks what about the payphone outside, he's told it's been dead for years.
They should say, okay, why did you build one out there in the first place?
I'm telling you.
Because that's what Jesus would do. They do what everyone does with Christianity. They don't give you a straight answer and say, just trust me, bro.
They again hear the phone ringing, and when Finn answers it, it's a boy who says it's cold and dark there. Finn says his name, and the boy says that they're not supposed to be here, and Finn says something bad must have happened to you. He tells Finn to find them as there is pounding on the outside of the payphone.
I was laughing rewatching this because I put it in another viewing before we recorded. Given we just talked about Scream, I was laughing my ass off expecting Ghostface to be on the other line at some point.
They call Terrence, who asks if the snow plowing is done, as we cut to a cross and Ernesto speaking in Spanish. Oh my god, this light up cross. Jesus Christ.
Literally.
Yeah. Gwen and Ernesto ask about some kids that had died here before, and they're told that this isn't some haunted tour, and we're getting some scripture thrown our way. So, boy, oh boy. You know, Derrison's carved out a nice career out of himself without any of his beliefs really showing up in a huge way. He is really good at building suspense in these horror films. Here, it's so pronounced. And I already mentioned that I kind of made a joke that this feels like a Left Behind horror movie. Matt, are you still feeling that at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the worst. I don't want to say the worst because, you have the right to put in your own faith. Stephen King's been his thoughts about religion very well known, so why not have a positive one? But for me, a lot of it just doesn't resonate. And more importantly, it's so ham-fisted that it feels like a pure flicks movie. And it feels inorganic because the first film doesn't really go that far down the religious road.
Pretty irritated at this film. at this point. I feel like it's trying to justify everything that it's doing, and it's not doing it well. Even the phone with Finn and these kids, I'm like, wait, are we literally doing the exact same beats that we did before on some of this? Yeah, some of this we do the exact same things we did in the first one. I don't understand the camp, because we're told that the camp's closed. We're not told the camp reopened, and these are the only people that got to the camp. Why are these people, like, none of the stuff that, I don't need it explained, but based on the stuff you explained, I'm also looking going, okay, none of this makes sense. None of this is adding up. So what does it matter? Oh, it doesn't matter. Then it shouldn't be a part of what you already told me. So, I mean, this thing is not written well. It really isn't. I think they had some ideas and they had some visuals, but I'm getting kind of irritated with what they're thinking this movie is based on what they're telling me.
The last film was so tightly written. And we are getting so many broadly drawn characters. We're going to get a couple counselors here in a little bit that I would have fucking cut out, quite frankly. Matt, there's just too much going on in this movie, isn't there?
Yeah, I think this one's overstuffed to a fault. It's almost like they had 2 and 3 in their heads, like that they were going to make 2 more movies, and they tried to force everything into 1 movie. Because I'm sitting here going, is Ethan Hawke even going to be in this movie?
Yeah, we get him for a little bit earlier, but yeah, you're right. I'm thinking the same thing.
Because I thought like the only stuff we were going to see with him was like archival footage or him just doing voiceover. Like literally, he's in a phone booth recording his lines. Like I didn't think we'd see him at all at this point, which I would have called false advertising, because he's top billed once again, and the mask is the one thing you see on the goddamn poster.
Gwen is chewed out for her bad mouth by this counselor who we're going to know as Barbara. And then Gwen responds by asking if she has always been a sanctimonious twat, which I actually kind of laughed at.
I use the word twat like Australians use a C word. It is one of my favorite words. If I call you a twat waffle, I love you or hate you. We talked about her demeanor in the first one and how great she was. And I don't think we get some of that to shine back through until this moment with the counselor. So I'm glad this religious cunt gets put in her place over and over again.
We're then seeing more of Hope's call as Gwen sneaks up and then looks up to see falling feathers on a corpse. And then we see an axe appear, as does a blood trail, as she wakes up to a pounding on her door. She gets up to answer it as the phone rings yet again. Gwen goes on a chase as Finn tells Ernesto that he has one job, to look after his sister. Gwen is once again having visions as Finn answers the phone, and it's the Grabber who says he of all people know that dead is just a word. He then says that he's here as the Grabber appears outside the booth in daylight, and Finn puts together that this was all a trap. He yells for Gwen as she's once again in a dream, and more visions of doors and walking toward them as the Grabber asks if Finn actually thought their story was over.
I sure did, based on how that last movie ended.
Matt, for fuck's sake, why isn't Robert Englund here? Why do we have fucking Ethan Hawke here? Because these are the lines that I'm hearing.
Oh, we might as well have had him say, like, you shouldn't have buried me or something.
Yeah.
Because he's written in this movie like he is Freddy Krueger. He's more theatrical. He's got one-liners. The only thing he doesn't do is say the word bitch.
But you know what? The more I look at him, like, if he hadn't been in this movie, I could have actually believed him as a Freddy if they were to remake it.
Yeah, but I feel like this was...
Yeah, this feels that quota for sure.
Yeah, it would have been typecasting if they just said, hey, you want to play Freddy? And he's like, sure. But it's also a thing of, like, I feel like Ethan Hawke's kind of wasted in this movie. And I feel like the first one was such a great showcase for him. It was a departure. He did a lot considering what he was restrained by with the mask. And this one, you could have, like, hired a body double and nobody would have noticed.
Yeah, and he had just had that role where he was nominated for an Oscar for, right?
Yeah, Blue Moon had just out. Blue Moon, Black Phone. I'm surprised he wasn't in Red Dawn.
I'm glad to finally get him. To that point, I didn't think we would. I thought maybe he wasn't going to be here, at least not in the makeup, in the mask, and doing that kind of stuff. He was so good. Matt hit it all. That first one, first time he's played a villain, such a departure, and it was fantastic. And I think it loses something with the way this one is done, but I can't say he's bad. And I do think he's kind of relishing playing this character, and I'm glad for that.
You know, you mentioned during the Scream series that your daughter likes a lot of those movies. Did she watch this with you?
Nope, we haven't got a chance to, but she hasn't. God, I want to show it to her.
Yeah, I would be anxious to hear her thoughts on it. And then show her Nightmare on Elm Street Dream Warriors right after. So the Grabber says that Finn murdered him and that fear is just a warm-up. Finn once again runs out yelling Gwen's name as he's told it's 3 in the morning, so stop yelling. They didn't run toward the shed, and Finn is still not guessing what the grabber wants. He says that he wants to hurt Finn in ways that he can't imagine for what he did to him. And then he says that Finn made him kill his brother, the person he loved the most, and then he killed him. Now he just wants to destroy him by destroying the thing that Finn loves most, and vengeance will be his. Another sad part about this movie, not just plot-wise, this was the last role of James Ransom right before he passed away, and he's the one who played the grabber's brother. He's barely in this.
It's like stock footage almost.
Yeah. Put a pin in him, though, because we'll see him again once we get to It.
Yeah. But also, I was thinking Ethan Hawke, before he shows up, I'm like, is this going to be like a Game of Death 2 situation?
Oh, jeez.
Where they advertise Bruce Lee's in the movie, and he's not, except for stock footage.
We see the grabber going after Gwen with an axe as these counselors.
Oh, that was right out of The Shining.
Some of the visuals, some of the looks, you can almost tell that they drew some shit that looked really cool, and they tried to ride around it. Because that look, like with him and the axe, and like when he's skating on, like that just looks freaking awesome. Wow. The story doesn't do it justice, but it looks cool.
No, I feel like this is one of those movies where they storyboarded everything first and then said, write a movie.
Definitely, because this is like a straight homage.
Exactly.
The shot of him with this axe on the ice skates. They said it's a straight homage to the movie called Curtains, which is from like 1983. And I remember that movie very well because it was back-to-back with Jaws 3 on cable when I watched it. And so, yeah, this is a straight-up homage to that. Gwen is thrown around the room and toward the furnace as Finn stops her. I thought this stuff was actually pretty good. And then knives are thrown. But folks, we are officially in a Nightmare on Elm Street film at this point. Like, this is exactly what happens to Tina in that first film.
I'm angry now.
Are you?
Yeah. I've gone from, okay, I like the setup, to I don't like what we're doing, and I don't think the contrived BS you had to get us to this camp doesn't fit with the rest of it. And now you get us here. This isn't an homage. This is just straight thievery. This is you breaking in with the subtlety of your masks going into a jewelry store in a mall and breaking the cases. There's no subtlety here. And I can't believe that they just go this blatant with it.
Anger is not the right word, but I wasn't expecting blatant plagiarism like this. You know, because there's a difference between a homage and just, to Adam's point, outright thievery. And I feel like this crosses that line several instances.
We're seeing Gwen have visions of the grabber as he just looks at her and leaves. Finn yells at Gwen to wake up as she looks around and she's told that she has the devil in her.
And now we became Carrie all of a sudden.
Yeah, now I'm having expected her to get locked in a closet.
We then have a huge close-up of a lit-up cross as we see a Sunday school session about what exactly happened. They accuse Gwen of being possessed, and this chick called Mustang is on a roll here. I do like her in this. We don't get enough of her, I don't think.
Yeah, between Mustang and Starlight, I'm like, are they setting these kids up to be strippers?
With these that or names? Run the Kentucky Derby, one of the two.
We also don't get an explanation. Who the hell is she?
Oh, Mustang? That's his niece.
Yeah, that's his niece.
Okay. I missed a line then, because I'm wondering why the hell this girl suddenly shows up.
Gwen says that she sometimes sees things that tell her the future, and other times it's the dead showing her things of the past.
Well, at least this is at least consistent, though, because in the first film she had visions.
Yeah.
Which I remembered, so at least this didn't feel like that much of a leap, because you at least had precedence for this. There's not a lot of the writing in this I can excuse, but that's one that's at least justified.
She talks about the kid who wrote the letters on the ice bucket, WBH, and she says they all want her to find them.
What, Blumhouse? WBH?
that would have been better than what it actually stands for. We're getting there.
Well, I was also annoyed that, of course, in a Christian movie, the mother's named Hope.
Yeah, I thought of that too. Finn brings up the grabber. They put together that he himself is Finney Blake. And Gwen says it was the grabber that got her in the kitchen, not the devil. And they're shown pictures of their mom in the camp. Armando says that now that they're here, it's their chance to put those kids to rest once and for all for their families and him. Finn recognizes the grabber from the pic and has revealed, guys, that he was called Wild Bill Hickok. And this is when Gwen...
apparently he was at the end of The Shining. Because, come on, man!
Gwen puts together that WBH was Wild Bill Hickok, and this is where he started his kills. Holy shit.
I think I have a hernia from all the gymnastics I had to do to get to this point.
Oh my god.
I don't mind that we're getting... One of my biggest fears that we were going to get, like a grabber origin story. If I'm going to give this a compliment, and we've been pretty complimentary, it's that at least this doesn't go the normal kind of route with that kind of thing. And praise be for that.
What kind of thing are you talking about specifically?
Just a standard origin story.
Okay.
You know, that we get.
Okay,
you know,
I get
you. Yeah, this goes a different route. And I'm glad to see that. This works in his origin with other stuff. But, oh my God. And to pull out some black and white photo, call Jack Torrance, man. It's just a step too far.
Yeah. Yeah. A black and white photo of a guy who, in the first movie, you don't see his face.
Yeah.
And they put two and two together. Oh, that's him.
And how did, I'm sorry, that photo did not look like Ethan Hawke.
I had to do a triple take to make sure it was Ethan Hawke. Yeah, I had to pause it to kind of verify.
The guy's been acting forever. There's footage.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, he's been making movies since Explorers.
Yeah.
Like, he was a kid actor.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably could have just called Joe Dante and asked for, like, production footage. And I'm sure there's plenty lying around. Because, all right, I'll compliment this. They don't give you every single piece of the puzzle, which I was worried they were going to do. Like, I thought we were going to get, like, flashbacks mm-hmm. of a yep. young... Basically, what they did in Freddy's Dead... Where you see the flashbacks of him, like, killing the mom, and he's after his child, and, well, we find out about maternal connections in this movie, so I'll put a pin in that, but I like yeah. that all the there is still mystique there. They don't give you everything, which is what I thought they would do.
We're not seeing him kill a rat. We
yeah, they don't do, like, yeah. you don't see him, like,
kind killing of the build-up of that kind of bull.
But I'm like, okay, was his brother ever at this camp, too?
Yeah, I thought of that, too.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because at some point, he had to go from this camp... to wherever they live in the first one.
All right, get this, guys. We're told that the grabber spirit is here because the spirits of ghost victims aren't at rest and the bodies are under the lake.
But he's not a victim. He was the perpetrator. Like, this guy's got, like, a John Wayne Gacy level of buried bodies.
Yes. Armando says that Wild Bill used the equipment for boys' hockey games. And so Gwen says that she thinks if they help these kids rest, it'll get rid of the grabber's power. Boy, this is straight Dreamweaver shit.
How? What kind of logic yeah. is that?
Yeah, I couldn't put that together either.
Is this in the Book of Ruth?
They start putting the pictures out as Armando hears a transmission. He turns on the light, and it's a snowman outside.
Gave you all the clues.
Oh, my God.
Well, I laughed in
the theater. I did, too.
And everyone looked at me like I was insane. I did the thing from Joker. You wouldn't get it.
Armando,
I literally said that in my head.
Armando starts communicating with the grabber as he finds some of his old drawings, one of which looks like that straight-to-video killer Jack Frost. Like the one that he grabbed. I pause it. I'm like, that looks exactly like that video box Adam from.
It truly does.
Holy shit. We cut to Finn smoking another joint as Armando says that the devil's lettuce is not allowed on this property. He says that Finn has really been through it as he has the look of quiet fury and deep rage. Finn says that he does get in some fights, and Armando says behind that anger is fear. And fear leads to the dark side. No, he doesn't say that. We then get a little bit of Armando's backstory as he says that he's met a half a dozen kids every year, and he knows for a fact that Finn is stronger than he thinks. He tells Finn to face his feelings and that they aren't going to let the grabber kill Gwen or hurt him. Armando then takes the weed away, saying that it's not even good shit. Which I actually kind of laughed at that.
Yeah, he went and smoked it.
Yeah, exactly.
What he did.
We cut to the next day as the search is on for the kids who died. Finn says that he and Ernesto are going to take shifts watching Gwen sleep, and they will wake her when she has a dream. She says,
seen this before.
Yeah, right? When Nancy's telling Johnny Depp to stand over her to watch her sleep, yeah. She says the grabber is too strong, and Finn responds, he thought that once too. Ernesto then asks if Finn really talked to his brother, and Finn responds that yes, he did. He says that his brother said that their dad didn't come back from Vietnam to leave his buddies behind, and he wasn't going to leave Finn behind. Holy fucking shit, guys.
Oh my God, I was thinking of the Big Lebowski. I didn't watch my friends die face down in the box. I was thinking of John Goodman. Because the Christians in this movie also don't roll on Shabbos.
Finn then says he doesn't know what's on the other side, but he knows there's something, and he hopes that it's good.
Okay, so apparently now, this movie is also proving that hell exists.
Yes.
So everyone should be going to Christian camps then if they're proven right. They'd be proven right.
My God. Finn tells Ernesto to wake him up in 4 hours. So now Finn's giving Ernesto...
Are they going to plug themselves now into Inception machines? And
I know.
They're going to go into like multi-levels.
We then cut to Gwen as she's dreaming up a storm. We're seeing the van, the toppled bike, the original kidnapping as one counselor rises up and says, Wild Bill. Ernesto sees Gwen get up and pushes her back down, saying that she's staying in bed tonight. Gwen then sees a long hallway, so she walks down it, only to end up at the house from the last film. We have more dream imagery as the grabber comes out and points inside the van. And she walks right into it. He then says that he's doing this out of kindness to her, and Gwen says that her mom dreamt of the first kid that he took, and of course he's the one who took her. He says he's going to show her the truth before he does what he has to do. She's seeing imagery from when her mom was hung and figures out, okay guys, that she didn't commit suicide. It was actually the grabber who killed her.
Well, I guess this is where I can put my anger card on the table, because I found this to be lazy and infuriating. You know, this is the break glass in case of emergency for lazy screenwriting. Turns out everything you saw was because it was revenge or tied into the previous movie, because Freddy does a similar thing in one of these movies, in one of those movies.
Yeah, he does it to that kid in Dream Warriors where he pulls him by the veins and it's shown that he actually tortured himself.
But like the whole thing of like, oh, of course he killed the mom and that's why this kid was strong enough to kill him. Oh my God, I hated this so much.
Me too.
Like that I got something that I actually care about a little bit.
Really?
I don't mind that they have the grabber, you know, kill the mom. My problem is everything that lead up to it. Why would he? Why is he showing her like that? None of that makes sense. I didn't like the lead up to the camp. I don't like that this is ripping off so many other movies. If this is what you want to tell, cool. I'm fine with this. And I like the way that it's done and the way that it looks. Because so much of this vision cam that they use, because they filmed it with 16, they filmed it with 8. You know what? I don't need the fuzzy shit on my screen. It makes it look like my TV's out of focus, and that pisses me off because of the way you use it. But I like that, you know, that this poor family went through some trauma, and it's not what they think it is. But my issue is that not even the first half and second half, each quarter of this movie is kind of not matching the quarter that came before it.
We're seeing a bit of the aftermath, and the grabber says that hell is different than you think. He says that they take the best parts and leave the worst parts, which is their sins. The grabber then asks what she thinks happens in this realm when she dies. She says that she thinks she wakes up. He says that he thinks she'll die. He then offers to help her find out as he stalks her. They go through the house as the phone rings again, and it's Felix telling her to hide. We have Felix back here. She's stuck in her dream as Ernesto yells at her to wake up. She does, and this means that Ernesto gets to slam the door before the grabber can come after them. We're then seeing flares all around the frozen lake as Gwen is being told to wake up. She's walking across the frozen lake to answer the phone, and the grabber says that he has every right to defend himself. We then see the grabber raise an axe and tell Armando to tell the boys I miss them as he makes Armando fall right in.
Okay. So she's having visions. And that's where so he can affect people in this world, but they can't affect him, but she sees him. But like the rules, there are none. They're writing whatever the hell they want. They're using him in whatever scene, in whatever way they want to do it, without connecting to the rules you set up or that have any logic or anything else. So the grabber can just kick him down into the ice because that's what the scene calls for. This is some bullshit.
That's why I hate dream logic. You always have the excuse or the built-in justification for a lack of logic is, well, it's a dream. What do you expect? I think when you're this far removed from the first movie, which was very stripped down with the supernatural, to then try to go overboard and then not take the time to create your own rule book is extremely annoying.
Now, I would be fine if he was doing this to Gwen, because they have that connection, or even to Finney, though I feel like that is separated at this point, but that he can physically interact with these other people that don't have this, it doesn't line up.
Adam, you bring up something that's actually a really good point, in that the best of the Nightmare on Elm Street films are the ones that establish rules and follow them. What are the rules here?
Well, because I don't know about that, because even the first Nightmare on Elm Street movie establishes rules, and then the third act they said fuck it.
Well, no, they established that once she grabs his hat, she can pull it out of her dream, so that is established.
Yeah, but that movie also falls apart in the
film. Well, yeah, there are issues. We're not talking about that movie. But you know what I'm saying, right? Like those films, this movie went so hard to be one of those films, but it's being Dream Child, not Dream Warriors.
No, at least with this, there's no I want to kill your unborn baby or that sort of stuff. Yeah. There's no Jacob in this movie, thank God.
Yeah. Gwen is pounding the
payphone. Because remember, this is a Christian movie, not a Jewish movie.
Yeah. Gwen is pounding the payphone glass as a grabber gets her from behind and is being rolled around as she bleeds. And this was actually pretty cool. I like this.
I had to rewind it because I was like, too. Did he just cut her throat? And no, it's because she had cut her arm getting through. But I can't believe they let this go with the fact that, you know, we're still fucking with kids here. Cool shot.
They're still yelling at her to wake up as the payphone explodes and the grabber is on his back. Gwen approaches him and...
The boy!
Gwen approaches him and says that she chose to come here and she can do what she wants as he did not bring her there. She says she understands now that in a dream she has the power too as she fights back.
God damn it! You're in my dream now, bitch!
Welcome to Wonderland, Alice. I mean, how many fucking Nightmare on Elm Street references can we do here?
Damn it. It's not... It's one thing, like I say, it's not an homage anymore.
No, you're right. But Matt, to your point, I mean, you said that Cargill has flat out said, yeah, that's what we were trying to do.
Yeah, I know, but that still doesn't justify
it. No, it doesn't. I'm just saying that. It's not like they were hiding it.
No, I know, they're not. But also, like, the side characters in this are not as interesting as the warrior characters.
Great point.
And I could see them going that angle if they had more, like, I don't want to call it... They should have Bible study classes that have the same like function of explaining these people that the straight talk only scenes do. Yeah. If you're looking for that type of comparison, and they're not here. But thankfully, I will say there is no, as much as I love Dream Warriors, the Nancy Doctor romance has never worked for me. So I'm kind of glad that's here. Although there's something coming up in a couple minutes that I can't emphasize enough how much I hated.
Let's get there. So Gwen says she later Wild Bill as she wakes up. Mustang then knocks on the counselor's door and asks for their help as Armando fell in the water just as they found one of the children in the lake and they need to find the rest with Armando out of commission. Barbara says she won't help with that demon child out there. Mustang says that she was the reason they were able to find Armando in time and that demon child saved his life and she calls out how what they're doing doesn't sound like Christian behavior to her.
Well, if there's one thing Christians are very good at, it's turning a blind eye.
You're not kidding. Finn finds Gwen as a truck pulls up, and it's Terrence.
Okay.
All right. I knew this was where you were going.
Oh, my fucking God. This is so... You can't establish a rule and then just break it down like he's the Kool-Aid man. You've set up isolation, and the roads are so bad... So he commit thievery to borrow the snowplow to get there. Oh my God.
It's so dumb. He came and I had to rewind. I'm like, okay, is this a new character? No, it's their dad. I could not Mr. believe Plow. This.
Yeah, I mean, they might as well have said he's psychic too. And
realized
I'm in trouble. So I left and pulled a Jedi mind trick on someone to steal the snowplow because... As it's established, this is a huge like traversal and pull in your third act.
Adam, what do you think about this twist? You seem to be going with this movie more than we are.
God, no, I'm angry. I mean, maybe, but I saw this coming. I mean, they set up, he calls somebody. He's like, hey, are we going to use the such and such? So I knew he was coming here to show up. I guess I'm just not surprised, so I'm not angry.
Terrence says that he came to get them, but Gwen wants to stay as their work here isn't done. When they mention the grabber's name, Terrence asks if this is more Gwen dream stuff. Finn begs her to go with, and she calls Finn out for being like their dad, who's pretending nothing's happening as Finn smokes his life away. Finn says of course he knows it's real, because all he ever thinks about is that no one knows what it was like down there. He says he doesn't want to be angry anymore, and he doesn't want to be afraid anymore. Gwen responds with, "You're the bravest person I know." But Gwen is still refusing to go, and she asks what he's going to do if she doesn't go, and then she tells him that their mom didn't kill herself. She explained how she remembered the camp and found the grabber who came to their house and killed her. So we're getting this whole isolation, this whole Finn dealing with his trauma storyline paid off in this conversation where, you know, this actor's doing his best. Not the most emotional scene. I mean, it's an emotional scene, but is it working for you, Adam?
No, it's... reading words on the page that they wrote. I understand that it's supposed to be catharsis for these people, but even just, come on, we're coming. No, I'm not. Okay. Yes, you're coming. No, I'm not. Okay. I'm doing this. No, you're not. Okay. Hey, mom didn't kill herself. Okay. I mean, it's just, I don't fault the actors because I think when they're given something to do, they chew it up really good, but this is really bad, man.
There's not enough like therapeutic sessions at this camp for me to fully buy this, because it just, they mention it at the beginning and they mention it at the end to tie everything together.
Gwen says the man who took Finn took their mom away from them, and her dreams aren't just dreams, they're real. We then cut to the next day as we hear a prayer. Oh my fucking God. Gwen's begging for help to take away his power, and we see her dreaming as she's being screamed at to wake up. That seems to happen like 20 times in this fucking movie.
I half expected Jim Caviezel to show up in this movie and throw ninja stars at the grabber to take him out with the amount of Christ allegories in this thing. Like, did Mel Gibson produce this?
There's not enough self-mutilation to fucking be Mel Gibson here. Finn doesn't believe this was an accident as the grabber comes up carrying an axe while on ice skates, as we mentioned earlier. We're seeing the counselors thrown around as Barbara is stabbed in the head. Grabber is breaking the ice as more of it starts cracking. He then grabs Finn and throws him as he yells at Ernesto to get away. I do love this corpse just plopping on the ice. I thought that was a nice visual.
I love that sound effect that they use.
Yeah. We see Gwen approaching while saying scripture. The grabber turns around and says, God's not here. She's alone, as he skates toward her. But Gwen says that she brought friends as kids start coming out of the ice and grabbing him. He then gets an axe in the head as Gwen says, the boys have been found. You're powerless, as she pulls off the mask. And guys, at this point, I half expect the souls to start pulling themselves from his chest.
Yeah, I thought this was going to be the ending of Dream Master where he gets pulled apart.
Oh my God. Finn says that hell isn't flames, it's ice, as he pounds the grabber's head into it multiple times.
Yeah, chill out.
They then stand back as the grabber falls to the bottom of the lake with axe in hand. Adam, how'd you feel about this ending? Me and Matt have already said our piece.
Oh, okay. two things. I have many things. Even just the, okay, you need to find the boys and that takes his power. You need to explain that. Okay, I will give you your conceit, but you still got to give me something about that. Because, hey, we found them. Okay, do they have to be brought up to the ice? Because they don't all surface. So, God damn it. The whole, you know, whatever, ice burns more than hell. Hey, you know what? I'm a published author as well. I've been published in multiple poetry anthologies, and that's about as fucking basic as sand melts and becomes glass on the feet. Like, Jesus Christ, man. Like, that is such a bad line. Like, that ChatGPT says, I'm sorry, that's a bad fucking line. But the grabber skating looks badass. I will say that. That looks pretty bad. And when he got that axe in the head, I wasn't expecting it. It comes from out of frame. Really nicely done. Pretty freaking cool. I learned they had to reshoot this end because they didn't think that they got enough catharsis out of it. So Finn bashing his head into the ice was because test screening said, no, give us more. But, okay, she's fighting with the grabber in her vision. So we see that from her vision. But Finn is wrestling with the air?
Yeah, what is this?
At the same time?
Yeah, is he punching air?
Yeah, what is so, this?
Look, I can go with the visualization that Finn can be affected, but is he there in the corporeal realm or is he not? You don't know your own rules because you decided to not figure it out. You had an idea that you didn't want to see through enough to think about it. So I got a real big problem when she's fighting him and then it cuts to Finn fighting with air. It looks laughable. At the same time, when I get these visuals with the grabber, the mask looks pretty badass when it's covered in ice. It looks, you know, nice that way. When it rips it off and we get the lower half of his mandible and it's just, you know, kind of burnt away because of the ice, it looks cool. But for every moment that I want to cheer, the movie slaps me in the face for being excited.
Ernesto asks if Gwen is okay as she kisses him. Finn tells Terrence, well done, as Gwen tells Finn that the boys brought the grabber to where he belongs. We then cut to Armando, who says that he's calling because he has some news about Calvin, which is they finally found him. What was this? Was this a drop line earlier? Was he looking for a kid or something? I don't remember this.
We had said that the kids all went missing and nobody had any closure.
Okay,
they so never he's knew giving what happened closure. To him.
Gotcha.
He's calling. You know what? If I get a phone call 30 years later from the camp counselor that my kids went missing at, I'm calling the police.
Yeah, right. We then see a phone ringing as Finn says it must be for you. She approaches it and it's Hope, who says hi and that it's beautiful where she is. My God, you know what this reminded me of, Matt? Lovely Bones.
Oh my God, you're right.
Yeah. Which is a tremendous book, but a terrible adaptation by Peter Jackson. Gwen says that she misses her.
That's also what happens when you replace Ryan Gosling with Mark Wahlberg.
Well, yeah. Gwen says that she misses her and Hope tells her that she's proud of her for saving everyone. Gwen then asks if she'll always be this cursed, and Hope says it's never a curse and she has to go. She then tells Gwen to tell her brother that she loves him, and she will tell Robin hi, as Gwen hangs up and just bawls her eyes out. I do give this actress a lot of credit. She is really selling it, but I don't know. Maybe it's just the previous 30 minutes. I'm just not with this.
I can't remember who Robin is.
Right?
That line happens, and I go, who was Robin? Now, unbeknownst to me, my wife was watching when I rewatched this, was watching from the top of the stairs. The last goes out, who's Robin? And I go, I don't know. So shit. That's a, God damn it. I mean, it got me a little, I get what they're going for, you know, and I'm okay with it, but it's a little, well, it's not a little, it's a lot schmaltzy.
I was looking through my iPhone looking for Creed music I could play to accompany this, because holy crap, this was... Normally when there's this much of a Christian jerk-off, the Catholic Church is being sued in Boston, so I couldn't... I was annoyed, and I felt like I was being browbeaten in a way that I have not seen in a very long time.
And you know what? You mentioned it earlier, but we didn't really talk about it. And it seems like we talk about this with every review we do, but this movie's just way too fucking long.
There's no reason for this to be a two-hour movie.
No.
There really isn't.
Gwen walks toward Finn and whispers in his ear, to which Finn drops in reaction. Terrence says it's time to go as he asks Finn how that Ernesto kid is. Finn responds that it could be a lot worse. Terrence then asks Finn if he himself has spoken to that Mustang girl, as Finn says to just keep his eyes on the road, as credits roll on Black Phone 2. Kind of a fun father-son conversation. I did kind of like this. Adam, did you like this?
I did. This felt natural. The relationship stuff, I think, works out.
All right, boys. Wow, what a discussion. I was not expecting this to get this animated. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Black Phone 2 Dream Warriors? Adam, go ahead, sir.
We loved the first film in this. I can't even really call it a series, but I really enjoyed Black Phone. I felt it was a throwback to movies that never really existed, but we all felt existed, and I think there was something special about it. By trying to redo it, but do something different, and to try to claim that your thievery is an homage, I think hurts yourself. This movie has some really good moments. It's got some really good scenes. It's got some pretty kick-ass visuals. It's got some good performances. And all that is held together with the flimsiest of scripts and plot and contrivances and just an utter disregard for trying to make sure your universe that you set up and the rules you set up make sense. And that's the downfall. I think if you don't have to change much other than write this better, and I would come out of this considerably more positive on this film. But I have to go with the words that are being given to me. You know, if, I don't know, maybe if this is a silent film and I play it over a score, I'm going to do nothing but enjoy it. But instead, you are more preoccupied with finding a way to make sure it looks cool, which it does, mostly. I don't know how you spent $30 million because half of this movie looks not necessarily as good as it did last time. But it's in the writing. It's in the writing. And it's kind of insulting that what you set up, you don't follow through on the rules you set up, you don't adhere to. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I like the acting from the characters. I like the setting enough once I get there. I think the contrivance to get there is utter bullshit. But once we get there, okay, you know what? I reset my expectations. But God dang, this is such a letdown. I felt like they rushed it maybe to hit a date. I don't think that anybody involved was excited past that initial phone call going, hey, the grabber calls from hell. Yay, I'm in. Guess what? You need to give me a little bit more. I'm going to be as positive as saying that I'm going to give this a 5. You know, hey, watch it. You may enjoy it. I could watch this again with reset expectations. Maybe I would enjoy it more. But it insults my intelligence at the same time that it gives me some kick-ass gore. And it doesn't do that in enough of a fun way. So 5 on 10. Look, it's not Joker 2 to Joker. But this is such a giant step down that I'm kind of pissed off that they made this movie.
Well, don't be too pissed off. There might be more. We'll talk about that here in a bit. Matt, what about you?
I don't like when I am told to just go with it while watching a movie. And I especially don't like it after I watched a predecessor that was very tightly plotted and managed to take a obscene premise with, you know, a phone that connects you to the souls of dead people and gave me a very compelling human story to encapsulate everything. Here, I just feel like I'm watching a demo reel for a director who had a lot of strong ideas, clearly, and certainly has a very clear perspective on religion and his beliefs. But it's held together by a script made out of duct tape, staples, and words scratched out with Sharpie and replaced with a different colored Sharpie. I found this to be a beautiful mess, but not in a way that I can be over complimentary, because I am a script writer, or I'm a story guy first and foremost. You know, I can look at the most beautiful painting and not do that for 2 hours. You know, I can go to a freaking museum and do that. When I'm watching a movie, I want something that will provoke me intellectually. And there are plenty of beautiful movies that have strong stories that are very abstract. You know, I like a lot of Alejandro Jodorowsky's movies, and look, a lot of his stuff is very stream of consciousness, but it's also case by case for me, because Terrence Malick, everybody loves him, and most of his movies I find to be all flash and no substance, and that man's biggest fear is an editor, apparently. This was kind of an encapsulation of everything I don't like about sequels, where, yeah, you did go in a new direction, but it's both at the expense of your previous movie and at the expense of a franchise that is tremendously well-known and I've been waiting to see come back. Now I'm kind of good without seeing another Nightmare on Elm Street movie, because this showed that while that void is there, you can't really replicate it. Certainly, if the remake did show that enough, I feel like this just further proves the point that no one has yet re-cracked it. So I do like the performances, though. I think this is a strongly performed piece, but the material they're given is not up to caliber. Maybe if this was done as a book, it could have been a little bit more fleshed out, but even at the runtime it is now, it's too damn long. But I also don't know what to score it, because I can't call it terrible, but I also, of the three of us, like the first one the most. So for me, this is a big step down. So I'm going to give the softest, pillowiest marshmallow of a 5 that I can possibly pull out of my Halloween candy bag.
All right, so 5 on 10 for Matt. You know, every year there are two guaranteed watches that I do. On the coldest, most snowy day of the year, guess what? I watch The Thing. On the hottest, most blistering summer day, I watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I think Black Phone 2, it wants really hard for it to be yearly winter watching. But in order to do that, you have to have a story that I care about. And for bunch of characters that I really cared about last time, and I know that because I rewatched it not a set of hours before I watched this one, I did not give a shit. And it is so much about the writing, and I think, Adam, you hit my feelings the most in that this movie is all concept. If you had just fleshed out this concept a little bit more, instead of just going all over the goddamn place, I think you really had something here. I think the ideas presented here are pretty good. I like the idea of the grabber kind of being in hell and being an influencer in a way. But at the same time, the way everybody's reacting and just all the Christian imagery going on here, I almost rebelled against this because, again, Derrickson has done a really good job of making himself into a pretty competent director who can scare the hell out of you. That first Sinister movie is so disturbing, and Hawk does it so well. I do find it interesting that the week before this movie was released, Ethan Hawke was on Jimmy Kimmel's show, and he didn't promote this at all. He promoted the movie that he was nominated for. And I don't know if even Hawke, as much of a good time I feel he's having, is really proud of this movie. I have the exact same score as you guys. I do have a 5 written down, because I do think there are good things here. But my God, after the high that was that first film, to go as low as you go here. By the end of it, I felt like the grabber having his head bashed into the snow dozens of times. My head was hurting from trying to pull logic out of what they were trying to do in this film. I think the actress who plays Gwen is very good. I think Finn is a little bit, he was good as a main character. He's a little off when it comes to being a background character, even though his arc is pretty pronounced. But yeah, this is a 5 on 10 for me. It passes the time, but I would compare it to the worst of the Nightmare sequels. No matter what we have to say about it, boys, this thing was a hit. It did make over $100 million. It made 130. Derrickson has said he wants the series to be, quote, quality over quantity, which doesn't explain why he did this one, but he says if they do a third one, it would have to be as good a script as he has done 2 times previous. Hawk has come out and said he loves playing this character. He'd be open to coming back as many times as he can. Guys, even though we weren't too high on this one, are you aching for more?
No, repent and sin no more. That's my statement going forward. I'm perfectly content with this not continuing. Unless, and I've been proven wrong before, either they have to go in a radical direction or pretend this movie never happened and just pick another one. But you kind of can't because of all the revelations and stuff. And I don't know how, but look, we've had plenty of... Not plenty. We've had some bad second movies and great third ones. I mean, a lot of people don't like Nightmare 2. I'm one of the people who does, despite its glaring problems. But I don't think there is a clear, blueprint on how to do this yet.
They could just grab the blueprint that those sequels did all those years ago and just grab a whole new set of people. Get away from Finney and Gwen. There's a possibility.
No, but you know what? If you told me there was going to be a third one, I'd be there for it. I want more Ethan Hawke. I think his performance was so good in the first one. Here, he's limited a little more. We don't get as much of... There's not as many variants of the masks to give the different emotions. Give Ethan more to do in the next... Ethan, like I know him. Give Hawk more to do in the next one if you bring it back. But yeah, I don't know. Season of the Witchit, maybe? Go there completely go. Different route. Obviously, he's killed before, so we have more that we can do.
All right, well... As people who listen to the show know and listen to the credits, Matt is our schedule maker. And you know what? I am going to have a hell of a month and a half. 2 months, actually. We'll get to those other two shows when we get to them. But we're going to go from Stephen King's Son right back to Stephen King himself coming up next. Even though it's not going to start off on a really good foot because we do have The Dark Tower coming up next week. But after that, we are going different seasons. We'll talk about different seasons next week when we finish up The Dark Tower. But Adam, are you familiar with The Dark Tower at all going into next week?
My familiarity with The Dark Tower is that I read the first two parts of the graphic novel. That's actually where I got to it, amazingly enough.
Interesting
book, The Gunslinger. Yeah. At least I'm assuming The Gunslinger is the first book because that's it the is. One I grabbed. And so I know very little bit about it, and I never went back. I never continued it, but I'll say it was a movie I was excited about.
All right, Matt. You know, out of the three of us, I'm starting the fourth book this week, but you might be more familiar with The Dark Tower than I am because I haven't really dived into that because it didn't have an evil dog or vampires in it. So I stayed away from The Dark Tower as a kid. You seem to be the fan of the series, aren't you?
Of everything I've read from King, I would say, and I've only read the first couple books because ain't nobody got time for that. But I do know of all of King's properties, it's one of the most beloved, and it's also the most expansive thing he's ever done as far as the lore and the quantity and how it ties into almost everything else. You know, it's the standing longer. They should call the series The Dark Tower 2, Standing Longer, because that's kind of what it is. And I was always excited because they had talked about doing a movie or a television show for the longest time, because with all the King adaptations that we got, some multiple adaptations in the case of Carrie, it took a long time to get a singular one. Let alone, and it wasn't done as a TV show. It wasn't done as a movie in King's heyday. It was 2016, and when you look at the two actors they picked, there's no reason it should not have continued until you saw the movie. But is it as bad as its reputation? Because, you know, it's kind of got a bad one, and it's really weird how it came out right before Stephen King movies were about to, repopulate in quality and name recognition with things like It and Gerald's Game. So it's a complicated history, and I'm excited to talk about it. And as far as different seasons go, it's interesting because Scott Derrickson has talked about directing the fourth short story in that, which has never... It's the only one that has not been adapted, so interesting connection there. Quite frankly, I don't know how you do that as a feature
Yeah, I was going to save that for when we get to different seasons, but there's no way you could adapt that story.
No, it'd be an episode, it'd be in a short or an episodic portion.
Yeah, maybe on Creepshow or something, the TV show.
Yeah, but it's also worth noting that, you know, the other three are all, we're talking about three Stephen King things in a row where there's no supernatural. Yeah, and movies that Adam has never seen, which is... blasphemy of all, considering one of them is the number one movie on IMDb and he still hasn't seen it.
I know. Oh, can't wait to talk about that anticipation. We'll get to all of that next week and the weeks following. And God, the series we're doing after that. Ooh, can I not wait to reveal that? But stay tuned. Lots of good things coming up on the site. But until next week, when we get to The Dark Tower, it took me a long time, but now I remember hell isn't flames, it's podcasting. Thank you, boys.
O grave, where is thy victory? O death, where is thy sting?
Scripture. God's not here. You're alone.
No, I brought friends.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Hey, you okay?
Yeah. Did I wake you?
No. Was that for real?
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You remember what I told you?
That I needed to see Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as the Alien film series, the ongoing Marvel films, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Exorcist films, the Jaws franchise, the Predator films, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Beetlejuice films, the Megan films, and so much more.
But man, that movie, it's the best ever.
I want to hurt you in ways that you can't even imagine.
Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Oh, you're not sleeping. I usually don't.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Finn, you rotting shit stain. Have you been listening this whole time?
Well, I'm still right here, so it's not like I had any choice.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
I'm with you. I've been with you this whole time.
Scheduling done by Matt.
What do you want? You're dead.
Oh, Finny. You of all people know that dead is just a word.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
weapon.
What weapon?
The one in your hand.
The phone?
Fill the receiver with dirt. Pack it in tight. Give it some heft.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You think you can slurp that a little louder? I don't think they can hear you up in Boulder.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
Hello?
You don't have much time. The grabber hasn't been sleeping. He thinks this might be it, that he's gonna figure it out.
Who's gonna figure it out?
His brother upstairs.
Hey, dude. Man, your arm is mint. You almost had him.
Good game.
Good game.
I'll say this, the band knows how to open a movie, because like if the opening of Sinister doesn't, pardon the pun, grab you with them all being hung.
Oh, I gotta see that movie. Shit.
Oh, that's right. You haven't seen
Nope. Sorry. Spoiler.
We gotta do those movies, Matt. We gotta do those movies. There's only two, Adam, so.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this also had, there was a VHS segment.
We didn't get reintroduced to... What's the name of Finn's dad again? God damn it.
Oh, Jeremy Davies?
I have no idea.
I forget his actual name in this movie. Finn's dad...
Terrence.
Thank you. We get a reintroduction to Terrence, Finn's... We get a little another brick in the wall, Adam, as they continue driving through some heavy fog and snowing conditions.
And Adam is singing along to the movie. I'm because it's Pink Floyd, you're damn right I am. So what? So you can't pay for Duran Duran, but you can afford a fucking Pink Floyd song in your movie? This thing had to cost more than the actor's salary.
I'm telling
you. This thing was made for $30 million. I'm sure 10 of that went to Pink Floyd's wallet.
Matt, you have no idea how big of a fucking Pink Floyd fan this dude was in high school. Like, didn't you go to a concert like that was our junior year or something like that, the Coliseum?
Yep, the Divisionville, the Division Bell Tour, Oakland Coliseum. Not the arena, the frickin' Coliseum. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Finn says that he can't...